Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge. Sarah Knowles is a global leader in employee well-being, health and safety, culture and trust. With over a decade of experience leading large, diverse teams in global organizations like Teleperformance, TTEC, and Concentrix, Sarah has built a reputation for driving strategic innovation and developing programs that priority equity and inclusion. Her work ensures employers feel valued, creating environments where belonging is not just a goal, but a lived experience. Sarah's expertise spans strategy, audit, people services, and change management, allowing her to manage risk, drive compliance, and shape the future of work for employees worldwide. Today, we'll delve into Sarah's strategies for building a culture of well-being and inclusion, her approach to global challenges, and the role leaders play. In our prep call, I found it really interesting also how a sense of purpose runs deep in her work and in her roles. So perhaps we'll have an opportunity to touch on that as well. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, well, thank you for having me.
No, it's our delight and our pleasure. So to start, Sarah, we, as you know, at the Council believe in remaining human-centric. And so we're going to start this conversation by centering on you, because you are human. And so the way we do that is we use a couple of questions from the Proust questionnaire. Marcel Proust was an essayist, and he found that asking these questions, and use them as parlor games, asking these questions allows us deeper insight into who you, Sarah Knowles, are and what you believe. So are you ready for your first question?
I'm ready.
All right. Which talent would you most like to have, Sarah?
Oh, there are so many, but I have always loved music. I love music and I admire musicians who play instruments, and whether that's the piano, the violin, the saxophone, the cello, when they do it and it's so effortless, to have a talent to create music that emotes and inspires and uplifts and connects people. When I think of my wedding, I think of the music I walk down the aisle to. When I think of sad times, potentially at funerals or other events, I think of the music that got me through those periods in my life. So for me, it would have to be have the talent to be able to pick up any musical instrument and play it beautifully.
Oh, that's amazing. That's beautiful. Do you play any musical instruments at the moment?
Would we consider the tambourine?
Every musician counts in an orchestra. It's like
Caesar Recruiter. It's cool for a very short.
That's it. As they say in orchestra, every instrument has a role to play, right? And that sort of leads to the workplace as well, right? Every individual has a role to play in the success of an organization, making that segue already. And the second question I have for you is, what would it be if you were to die and come back as a person or thing?
Ooh, I mean, that is a really good one. I would have to say, if I had the choice, I would come back as a dog. I have a little toy poodle. He's called Max. He's 13 years old. And I've got to say that he teaches me amazing things every single day. He has been on this earth for 13 years, and we have never even once had a conversation. So I suppose he's taught me that actions speak louder than words in that respect. He stretches as soon as he gets up. He plays for hours with endless bounds of excitement. He finds joy in the smallest things possible. If you drop a pee on the floor, it's like you've given him the best gift ever. He's forgiven swiftly. He greets people with excitement and joy. He loves to be outside and he loves to sleep. So I think if I had the choice, I'd probably come back as a dog.
What an amazing characterization. You know, I've never sort of heard somebody describe their pet in such a well-rounded way. And then, yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want to be a dog, right? If that's the life of a dog, who wouldn't want to be a dog? That's a great. So, Sarah, let's talk about, and you have deep expertise in the area of well-being and human resources, many other things. So I want to start by asking you a bit of this journey, and it's in some ways from my perspective, because I know in our prep call you have an alternate view, is that certainly in working in this field for about 20 years, and 20 years ago, there was a lot of talk about engagement, right? And we had chief engagement officers, and there was the link, and still to this day, you know, many research reports about the link between engagement and productivity as it relates to the workplace.
So we would have chief engagement officers. And now we see the term well-being being used far more than, I mean, certainly 20 years ago, we didn't talk about it here in Canada or North America as much. So I see it as a shift. I know that you have an alternate perspective to this. So may I ask you to talk to us about this what I, to me, it appears this rise or greater understanding of well-being.
Yes, I think for me, engagement and well-being are not mutually exclusive. I think the connection between wellness or well-being and employee engagement is one that is and should continue to be robust and also mutually reinforcing. I think wellness programs directly contribute to better employee health and well-being. I think employee engagement and the engagement activities have a direct impact on the way that people feel whilst they're in work and also therefore their wellness while they're in the business. I see both sides of the house because I think I've always been in wellness or occupational health, safety and wellness type roles. And engagement has always been there, bolstering the work, communicating that work to the people for who it matters and who it's intended for, making sure that they know about it and how they access it and how they engage in it. And, you know, even with my own employer at the moment, we have an engagement department, but of course, we also have the wellness team. So I see those two things as separate pillars, but that actually create the employee experience overall.
Fair. So the umbrella term that, so to speak, might be then employee experience. And within that are all of these compositions. In some ways, I actually also see a well-being as being the umbrella term. Now, right, that we've broadened from engagement to understanding that in order to have true engagement, we have to be broader in our perspectives, which includes obviously well-being and well-being, not just being the tight health and safety, but also mental well-being and social well-being, right? That we've also have a greater understanding and perhaps as a result also of the pandemic, and I'll ask you to comment on that these elements of social and mental well-being are just as important to you within the workplace as other pieces. Would you agree?
I think any employer, they want their people to bring their best self to work. It's in your best interest that your employee comes in and feels their best self, like they can speak to you about anything. So without fear of discrimination or stigmatization, that they can be their whole and true selves at work. And the reality of the situation is that we all face things on a daily basis, whether that's financial stresses or someone cut you up on the way into work. And so being able to wrap your arms around people and say, it's okay to feel how you feel and we're here for you and here are the tools we have for you. And here's some proactive information to perhaps stop those reactions from happening in the first place or help you to choose a different way to react to them is so powerful. And just going back to what you said earlier about potentially well-being or wellness being the umbrella, even when we think about diversity, equity, and inclusion, if there's no DE&I in the workplace, then there's no well-being. If there's no well-being in the workplace, then you can't say that you have DE&I. And engagement for me is kind of the thread that wraps all of those things together and says to people, hey, here's all the amazing things that we do for you.
That's great. Thank you for defining that and helping people to navigate the way through all of these terms. I've also noticed that a passion of yours or mandate of yours in the past has been resiliency. And I think it's a word that's bandied about a fair bit. And yet I'm not sure everybody understands, and perhaps even our leaders, and what that means. And so what can you define what it means to be a resilient leader, a resilient team member? And what does that mean in the age of AI?
Yeah, so I think resiliency is not something that can necessarily be taught. It's not a light switch where you go through a resiliency training and then all of a sudden you're a really resilient person and can deal with everything. We all react in different ways based on our upbringing, our frame of reference, where we are in our lives to situations as and when they arise. So the key thing is to understand what those thoughts and feelings are and how we process them, and then try to adapt tools that can help us to feel comfortable when we're in those difficult situations, whether that's to deal with it ourselves or to access and leverage support from other people. So I think resiliency and well-being, of course, they go well hand in hand. And so some people will just say well-being or wellness, and it encompasses everything. In other roles that I've been with, there's been a real focus on well-being and resiliency. But essentially, it's how you navigate the ups and downs of life, how you feel about situations as they arise, how you deal with them, how you process the emotions. So again, no amount of training, if we went through a training session today, it wouldn't be that tomorrow you woke up and automatically felt resilient. It takes a little bit of time for you to be able to understand, digest, and adopt those really good best practices that help you to navigate the ups and downs of life. Life's a roller coaster, and it undulates for everybody.
And it feels in the recent years that it seems to undulate faster and more often, and, you know, that it's not, I mean, these are not small waves. They seem to be crashing, right, waves from pandemic to socioeconomic, political, turbulent times. I mean, it's wild. So I think that's super helpful, because then, you know, if I want to be more resilient, what I'm looking to do is understand where are the resources that can help me. So to your point, it's not that I have to possess everything. But it's also part of resiliency is saying, okay, I'm in this particular state, whatever it may be, and here are the places or the people or the resources that I can turn to assist me. So I'm resilient because I allow myself and I encourage myself to access those resources.
Yeah. And so in the past, we've done sessions, so it could be, I think the first place, as you said at the beginning, is what is resiliency and what does that mean to me? But that's not enough, because we can't just stop there. So it's what's resiliency in this specific situation and what tools do I have? And then also, how do I maintain my resiliency? Because the challenges that we meet in life, they're not all going to be the same. So how do I continue to adapt and continue to grow my resiliency levels? And so for me, it's a big part of life. As you navigate through things, you're like, oh, that's the coping. That's how I managed to get myself through this situation. And let me go and tell Bob and Sarah and, you know, Susanna about this, because actually they might really want to know about it too. Or Swati went through this experience and she gave me some great advice. So for me, it's all about sharing and taking really positive, affirmative steps to understanding what you're navigating and moving forward. And also recognizing that you have the ability to do that and it was within you.
Mm-hmm. And the confidence, I guess. Yeah, the ability and the confidence that you can get through this, in essence. And it's interesting because, I mean, I certainly with my 9-year-old, I'm constantly trying to develop that in her, right? The confidence and the ability to know that whatever she's navigating, whether it is playground, you know, interactions with her schoolmates or so, that you can get through this. And somehow then, you know, we sometimes forget as adults that we also have those abilities. So Sarah, you are global leaders. We have this great privilege of asking you also questions in a global context. How would we define, is there any changes or things that we need to consider when we're thinking about well-being in a global context? Are there factors that a well-being strategy needs to take into consideration as we're moving around the world or working around the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, well, there is no one size fits all for wellness, whether that's, you know, your own personal wellness that you're looking into, or if it's part of an employee wellness program. So we have to be mindful of the differences. And a big piece of this is, for me, wellness is a relationship. On a personal level, it's the relationship that we have with food, the relationship that we have with sleep, the relationship that we have with other people, the relationship we have with colleagues, the relationship that we have with our employer. And it's also therefore a big part of communication, because the best relationships are built on really good and solid communication. But part of communication is also understanding cultural nuances, because something that works, let's say, in the United States from a wellness perspective, probably unlikely to work in the United Kingdom and may not hit quite as well in a country like India or in the Philippines. So all of this stuff needs to be taken into consideration. So not only have you got the individual human factor, how do we connect with that one person because we're all so beautifully and intrinsically different, but also how do we consider and navigate cultural norms? And the kind of regional frame of reference around wellness. And a prime example of that has been, and we've all seen it, wellness stigmatization and how people adjust to it. Some countries are a lot more comfortable in having resources and supports available for people. In other areas, we've seen it not being spoken about quite so much, or it's actually quite shameful to speak about it. So it's all of those things that require really careful consideration to make sure that the program that you have from a global standpoint is globally aligned, but also has the flexibility to adjust where it needs to.
So think globally, act locally, I guess would be, right, would be the mantra. And recognizing that as the cultures evolve or change, or as there's greater openness, let's say it is a more restricted or stigmatized culture, then there's greater resources available, right? But respecting in where you're operating the sort of a culture that is there at the time.
Yeah, and it doesn't always necessarily need to be resources. In areas where that's the issue, maybe it's how you communicate. Maybe that comes back to, for employers, your company culture. We understand that your cultural frame of reference is this, but our culture is that we encourage you to discuss these things with us, that we have an open door policy, that we have resources available. And it's that positive wellness culture within the company that draws people in. So sometimes it doesn't necessarily need to be a physical thing or an actual resource. It can be taking the time to explain and communicate about why this is important and why you feel passionate about it as an employer.
Sure, that could open, I'm sure, a lot of doors, right? Rather than just saying, here's a program, we're first going to build that understanding, that awareness of, and then it's not that there wouldn't necessarily be receptivity, but it's perhaps something that had not previously been thought of or discussed or even explored.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I noted down, you said wellness is a relationship, and you said whether it's with food or people or other factors. And so that sort of brings me the notion of wellness is a relationship with people. And as we're thinking about inclusion and equity, which is, you know, always a through line for us here at the Employee Wellbeing Council, how does wellbeing strategy ensure that equity and inclusion is taken in? And I know that you also spoke a little bit earlier about the DEI being a piece of engagement and wellness, but perhaps you can further expand on that, please.
Yeah, and I think for me, always from my experience, the engagement, DEI, well-being have always lived together with health and safety and other things. That's always been my working experience, and it's always been a great place to be. I understand for some that that is not the same. But I think when it comes specifically down to the wellness program, it's also all the things that we've just spoken about, because making sure that it is equitable is partially about understanding the culture and making sure that the program has the appropriate level of flexibility and realizing that the people who are going to be utilizing the services or accessing the program are also individual and have their own needs. For me as well, it's also about not making this mandatory. It's something that's for people, not to people, or to put onto people. So it should be that you, within your realm of comfort, when you're ready, have resources that you can access either by speaking to an individual, or you can read about them on a portal, or you can listen to a podcast about them, or there are quick fixes of information and infographics so that we're sharing things in a way that is accessible to everybody.
Great. Amazing. And I'm thinking, and I was just trying to think, when am I going to ask this question? Because I really, in our prep call, I love the way you talked about your purpose, and I mentioned it in the introduction. So I want to give a space for you to talk about your role and how you came to your role. But I think I'm going to ask one more question prior to asking that. I'm just giving you a preview of what's coming down the pipeline because it wasn't on the document. So, you know, in parenting, which, you know, I have had the privilege to be for about 9 years now, and we oftentimes talk about being a healthy parent. You can't be a healthy parent unless you're sort of an healthy adult, or you can't raise healthy children unless you're a healthy parent. And I would suggest that's the same in leadership. And we've had discussions with other leaders about sort of the notion of leadership and what does it mean to be a leader, how important it is also to give yourself the time or to reflect, pause and reflect. And same with, the, you know, well-being as a leader. How do leaders ensure? Because you might have some leaders who are just kind of giving, so to speak. And so how do leaders ensure that they're also monitoring their well-being?
This is something that I think really has been in the spotlight now over the course of the last 5 years, I would say more so than ever before. And what I would say is that leaders for me are influencers. When you're a leader, whether that's a leader who has a team of people or a leader who has a department or someone who just has the natural ability to lead and inspire others, you're an influencer. And so people look to you and how you behave and how do you prioritize yourself and how do you find harmony between work and home and other priorities that you have? How do you prioritize your day? And so I think it's really important for all leaders to be mindful and cognizant of the fact that you are setting an example to others, whether you intend to or not, whether you're a servant leader or not. People look to you to see how you behave and how you handle certain situations and also how you care for yourself. For leaders as well, prioritizing self-care is so important. And we all know that self-care does not have to be spa days with champagne and caviar and expensive massages. It can be the basic things like getting up in the morning, eating breakfast, brushing your teeth, having a nice hot shower, and walking or exercising. So, because it's so individual. So I think it's also important for leaders to be talking about their self-care routine. Like, what did you do for you today? How did you show up for yourself today in a way that meant something to you? Because people are watching and they'll always watch. It's part of human behavior.
I love that phrase. How did you show up for yourself today? I love that not only for leaders to ask themselves, but in some ways also sometimes to ask their colleagues, their team members, right? In maybe not every day, but sort of reminding people about the importance of that self-care. Like, how did you show up for yourself? You're showing up for the organization, you're showing up for your family and your friends and your colleagues, but how did you show up for yourself today? I think that's a brilliant question. And then also recognizing and acknowledging, I think, that it's not the same for everyone and respecting that. Because I know historically, right, you might have had a leader who was a marathon runner and therefore self-care was seen as, or the ones that were also runners and athletes, right? It was sort of adjudicated that that was a better way than taking that walk along the lake or cuddling with your dog or whatever the case may be. So I think it's also appreciating that self-care can have many formats.
Absolutely. For some people, it can be making time during the course of a busy day to go and get yourself a warm drink and sit down for 5 minutes. It's so different for everybody. And I suppose that's the beauty of self-care, is that there's something out there for everyone, but we should all be encouraged to explore what those things are for us and put them in a toolkit. I know what works for me at the times when I need it the most. And I have my little toolkit ready to plug and go of, it's like giving myself a warm hug during the course of the day. If I'm hectic busy, I know that there's something there that I can leverage that will keep me going for the rest of the day.
And I think we're growing. I think in organizations and in sort of leadership philosophy, I think the notion of self-care is really expanding and that it's important. Again, just as you earlier said, people don't leave themselves at the door, right? I mean, historically, when we think about, you know, our traditionalist past, in the 50s and 60s, it was sort of this expectation that your home life, right, ended the moment you walked through the, or whatever was going on in your personal life ended the moment you walked through the company doors. And now we very much have a recognition that people bring all of themselves to work.
Yeah. And I think you maybe even touched on it earlier, but in the world of AI and all of these advancements that we see, I don't ever think we should forget the importance of human connection and being a sentient human and what that means and everything that that involves and investing in ourselves to make sure that we maintain that and perpetuate it forward.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I just wrote an article where I said we need to remember humans are not widgets, right, in this age. And I don't think there's a distinct drive to do so, to forget that we're, right, that we're sentient beings. But I think we sometimes get lost in the blinginess also of technology and the efficiency it can create and the opportunities it can create. And yet while we're excited about all of those things, I 100% concur with you, right? We need to remember to thread that human centricity, and hence also our council and the work that you do, is to ensure that we remain human centric throughout all of this. And part of that human centricity is purpose, I would suggest. We've had a number of leaders talk about purpose, and having met you, you talked about your purpose and why you are where you are. It isn't by happenstance. So if you wouldn't mind explaining a little bit your career path, because I think it's really interesting, because it just really is, you've reached such senior levels, and it's in part because I'm sure of intelligence and competencies, but I think it's also part of a result of purpose, your deep drive. So if you can,
of course,
tell us a little bit about.
Well, I am from, I'm born and bred in the northwest of England, not too far from a city called Manchester, which anybody who's a football fan, I'm sure, will know. I get in taxi cabs all over the world and they say Manchester City or Manchester United. And I think neither. But, you know, Manchester was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. And so many people who lived in Manchester and walked the cobbled streets back then worked in the factories and, you know, broke their backs and, you know, hurt their bones to try and create a better life in this smoky city. And there are many people who didn't get to go home as a result of the work that they were doing. And there were many people who did go home, but their lives were never the same again. And so learning about this rich history and having a real passion in where I was from and what it meant to be Mancunian and what my ancestors had done, I really had this sense of purpose that nobody should go to work and return home worse off. Nobody should go to work and not return home at all directly as a result of the things that they were working on. And so I've committed my life, like I say, through either health and safety or the well-being and mental health work, to making sure that people come to work and don't go home any worse off than they arrived, if not feeling better for it, feeling supported, cared for, that there's a community that's there for them, that people care about them, that they're safe in the work that they're doing. And so I just have this real passion about what I do, and I have done my entire working life.
Yeah, that's great. And so there's a couple of things I just learned. One, Mancunian. I did not know that that's what folks from Manchester, right? That's how we refer to folks. But I love the phrase, no one should go to work and come home worse off. And I think part of the reason I wanted you to tell your story and your purpose is because, as you said, Manchester being the heart of the Industrial Revolution. And now, as we're moving into the world of AGI, that phrase still remains completely relevant. Right. So now, though, we're not worried maybe about somebody, you know, breaking something or losing their life directly as a result of going to the workplace. I mean, those things still happen. And so they're still right. We still monitor that. But when we think of perhaps with psychological safety or mental health safety or whatever other forms of safety and well-being there is, that no one should go to work and come worse off because we're now in the age of AI. I think that mantra is still right. Very much. Holds
absolutely. And there are so many advancements that we're seeing and so many beautiful ways in which I think AI can help and support people either as a customer or in their employment as we navigate forward. And also AI tools that will, I'm sure, undoubtedly come out to support people in terms of how their medical care happens and works for them. But we should also be very mindful of the fact that back in the days that I was speaking to, it used to be okay to park the ambulance outside the factory and say, we know that this work is dangerous, but there's an ambulance parked outside. And we've shifted. We've just completely shifted.
We have to have that, right?
To say it shouldn't ever have to get to that point. And I think our full focus should be on, and what's next? How do we now take this to the next level in the preservation of human well-being, human safety, and all of the things that make us the incredibly special and individual people that we are in the workplace.
That's it. And so as I come to the last sort of formal question, we want to always leave our listeners, our leaders, with practical advice. So what is one thing that I can do as a leader today, Sarah, to ensure my well-being and that of my team?
Oh, that is a great question.
You could say two. One or two.
For me, I would say be available. I think this is the best way I can say it. Be available. Be available to your team. Be someone who is available, who is approachable, who makes time to listen, to engage with them, and to get to know who they are. But be available to yourself and recognize when you need you to show up for you, when you need to take a step back, when, at times even when you may need to step forward and push yourself a little bit more. So I would say be available to yourself and to the people that you serve in the workplace.
Amazing. And don't see it as a weakness. If you choose to be available for yourself, don't see that as a weakness, right?
It's a strength.
It's a strength. It's a strength. Yeah. And so finally, if there's one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self, and in the past, sometimes I would give however many years, but now I've realized I best not do that unless I offend. But let's say you've just, you know, come out of post-secondary, out of uni or so, and you're in your career, in your early start of your career. What is one piece of wisdom you would give your younger self?
I would say stick with it. And I'm so glad I did. I was talking about matters of mental health and health and safety when it wasn't necessarily cool to do that and when it wasn't something that was being discussed. And I stuck with it. And I was so blessed to have incredibly amazing leaders who saw it, understood it, also believed in it, and helped me to drive it forward. So I would say, stick with it and you'll get there in the end.
That's a great piece of advice. Thanks so much, Sarah. On behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council, it was a delight to have this conversation with you. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites While Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.